The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
My next guest, Ruth Fitzmaurice, has been reminding me about the job she used to do here in The Last Word many years ago, a job that is no longer in existence because there was a time between before texts and tweets where we used to take phone messages. And you used to have to deal with all sorts of people ringing into The Last Word.
That's right. I dealt with all the angry people, mostly angry people, answering the phones. And sure, that's how I honed my my writing skills, crafting beautifully worded messages for The Last Word.
And you've written your new book, I Found My Tribe. And I'm going to ask you about your tribe in a moment. But tell us a little bit about Simon. You have been here on The Last Word before and you've been in Today FM talking a little bit about your experience and Simon. Simon is a film director and writer. He has motor neuron disease. How long now?
He was diagnosed in 2008, so it's advanced motor neuron disease now. He is on a ventilator and he can only move his eyes. He uses an eye gaze computer to talk, which is basically like it has an infrared strip on the bottom of the computer and it picks up his eye movement, and he can type out words, phrases, letters, which a bit like predictive text on your phone. You can then, it can then construct phrases that he has used before, and he types out sentences that way and then hits speak and an American voice speaks for him, electronic American voice.
What an extraordinary technology to have.
It's amazing because obviously I joke he can control the world from his computer. He can also control the television and lights in his bedroom, and he has one of those Echo things that he talks to. We actually changed the word from Echo because I don't know if you heard Echo, she has quite a sexy voice, and she was called Alexis or something, or Alexa, and I got a bit freaked out with the Alexa, you know, turn. thank you, Simon. You know, so I don't know how I feel about this electronic woman in our bedroom. So she's Echo now.
She's Echo now. Okay. And just tell us a little bit, though, for people who aren't familiar with motor neuron disease, what is it and how does it impact on somebody?
Well, yeah, motor neuron disease, when he was diagnosed, I knew nothing about it either. As much as anybody else, the Stephen Hawking association was all I could associate with it. But it attacks the nervous system. So you lose function, but you can still feel everything. So it might start in a different onsets, limb onset, or with Simon, it started in his foot. So he just developed he said his foot went a bit floppy, and he went through a whole load of testing then for about 6 months, because it's really diagnosed in the absence of any other diagnosis. A whole huge system of tests that are really horrible, nerve tests and things like that. And then when you finally get the diagnosis, it is 3 or 4 years to live, because once it affects your lungs, once it gets to your lungs and you can't breathe, that's usually the end of the road.
So that says Simon has a remarkable will to live.
He has, and he also obviously has a ventilator now to breathe, which he was diagnosed in 2008, so really the 3 or 4 years to live was, his escalated even quicker than that. He went into respiratory failure in 2010. He went into hospital with chest infection, pneumonia, and it just escalated into respiratory failure. And in an emergency situation, he was put on he was intubated, basically, you know, which is the tube down your throat. And I think then it was a case of they didn't really know what to do with him. So he was stuck in ICU for about 4 months while we figured out a package with the HSE to try and get him home again, because obviously we had young children. I was pregnant with I'd had him at that stage. Sorry, we had 3 children. So many babies, I can't remember.
You were 5. Yes.
We had 3 young children, 3 young boys at the time. And so obviously we just wanted to get him home, and he could still speak at that stage. He still had some arm function. He was in a wheelchair. He couldn't walk. His legs couldn't move anymore, but he was still very much, it doesn't affect your brain. So he was still completely Simon, and we just wanted to get him home. So that's what we did.
And he's been on the ventilator ever since?
He's been at home ever since on the ventilator, and that was 2010. And then in 2012, we had twins.
Which everybody just thought, hang on a second, that's remarkable. That's a bit there, yeah. What? How did that happen?
It's kind of the, okay, how did that work?
Don't go into details.
No,
it's okay.
Okay.
But that was an enormous decision to make, wasn't it? I mean, a real life-affirming decision that you decided, despite his illness, that you wanted to have an even bigger family than you already had.
Yeah, well, thanks for saying that, life-affirming, because that's really the way I see it. And I know a lot of people have opinions about it. And I don't know if, for me, it's just a no-brainer. It was the opposite of death and of being in hospital for 4 months. And we were celebrating having our family back together. And it was a beautiful distraction. Babies are the ultimate, you know, distraction to death and illness. And obviously, we didn't expect it would be twins.
Imagine the shock you must have had. And also then having to tell Simon, actually, yeah, it's not just a baby, it's twins.
Well, luckily, he was with me. It was the 20-week scan, actually, because we were on the midwife scheme. And I have big babies anyway. I've always said that they've, so I just presumed it was another big guy in there. And at the 20-week scan, we went in and the lady said we were going to try and find out the sex, obviously, because we had three boys and kind of hoping we might get a girl. And she said, well, you do know it's twins, right? And I said, you're joking. And she sort of looked at me a little bit insulted, like, if this is my job, I don't make jokes like that. And then she said, twin number one is a girl. And we both burst into tears. And yeah, it was a real, at the time, I think family were worried about me too at the time and thinking, oh, eye roll, Ruth's crazy. This is just another sort of stress on her. But everybody, it had the same effect on everybody when we found out it was twins. It just was a boost for the whole family, and it just felt like this little miracle, really.
But it was a lot to take on. I mean, five children is a lot to have in a family, as I know, exactly. But to have that situation, five children, but also having to care for your husband, care for him physically, and I know you have assistance, but also emotionally, and to care for yourself as well in those circumstances, that is a lot.
Yeah, well, you know what mothers are like. You know, the caring for myself kind of happened a few years later. At that stage where you're in the thick of young children, you don't really think about yourself much. But that's always really been my answer to any of the pain and the stress of illness in our lives is, you know, if it's difficult, I just throw a puppy or throw a baby into the mix, and that kind of chaos just makes me happy, you know. So
hang on, you have dogs in the house as well, do you?
A dog, a cat, until recently a hamster. My son Rafe is the animal lover, and every birthday really it's another pet. It's crazy, and I just can't say no.
But you also have other people helping you. That's another thing, that your family has almost been extended by the fact that you actually have to have people coming in physically helping you look after Simon.
Yeah, and in a way, obviously before respiratory failure, before Simon ended up in hospital in 2010, I was very much doing it on my own. And in a way, that was a more difficult time. I had two young children, pregnant with another little boy, and caring for Simon by myself, and there was no assistance. And for me, that was the more stressful time, where really I was going a bit crazy. But when he came out of hospital, he has nurses and carers to help with all that physical stuff. So I was freed up from doing that. I still, if there's a gap in the roster and no nurse, I will fill in and do it. But it allowed us to become more husband and wife again, and that was nice. Obviously, the flip side of that is that you have all these strangers in your home, and it being agency work, they tend to be passing through, and we do get to keep really great people, but inevitably they move on. And having people in your home constantly makes it very much a public space. It changes the shape of your home. And that was something that I had to get used to, and I'm still getting used to. You know, it's a constant struggle, really, hence the sea and all that.
And which is what I was just about to get to, because the book I Found My Tribe has the cover of you plunging, swimming into the sea, and this has become your release. Tell us all about this.
Well, yeah, as I said, I think the whole public house and busy house meant that I was sort of forced to go out past the boundaries of our home, in that sense of a home, and look elsewhere for a bit of solace. And and in a way, I feel really lucky for that, because I just was gifted all these amazing friends and humans that I now kind of count as family, really, as well. And you know, I live in Greystones, which is by the sea, and when I had young children, I just was too busy driving past it with young children. You're just too busy for that kind of stuff, and it was there, but it was not something I really noticed. And it was really by accident. I I ended up at the marina one day because a friend of ours, Galen, who is a journalist, Galen English, he was in a bicycle accident in 2014 where his bike went into the back of a lorry on the N11 and he ended up paralysed. And Galen was a triathlon man, amazing guy, and very, very, very athletic. And on the year anniversary of his accident, he got a group together at the marina in Greystones, and they carried him into the water, and he swam the entire way around the headland just using his arms, and it was totally awesome, you know. And we all got in with him just as a form of solidarity. And his wife was Michelle, who was an old friend of mine, but we, you know, hadn't really connected in a few years. We were watching her on the sidelines, and she just looked terribly sad because swimming was something they'd done together, and she hadn't swum in a year since his accident. She just couldn't go back to it. And another friend of mine, Afric, was there too, and we sort of looked at each other wordlessly in that way the close friends do, and went, oh no, we're going to have to do this. We're going to have to get Michelle back in the water. And the following week, there we were on Greystones Beach with our gaggle of toddlers and various dogs in September, about to head into the water. And we didn't set out to do it every day, but it just sort of... We did it once and it was awesome, and we did it another day, and then it was day after day we just kept doing it.
Why was it awesome for you?
Well, yeah, it's hard. Well, I suppose it's hard to describe. I spend the whole book describing it. Swimming in cold water has a certain, I suppose it has a certain physiological effect. There's lots of things going on. You're plunging into freezing water for a start, so it kind of resets your body. So no matter how you're feeling, you know you're always going to feel good when you get back out. But then also, there's sort of a mental process that you go through where, particularly in the depths of winter, I mean, obviously not at the moment where it's sunny and balmy and half the town are down on the beach and swimming. The water is really warm at the moment. But when it's cold, your brain is just telling you, don't do this. This is crazy. And so you're bypassing your brain or not listening to it. And it's sort of like this mental process that you go through. And when you come back out, you're almost laughing to yourself, going, you know, it's a sort of a lesson in you shouldn't always listen to your brain. yeah, you just always feel good. And I suppose there's an adrenaline rush to that too. So,
does it allow you to clear the head though as well, sort of forget about everything else, just to concentrate on the moment in which you're in?
Yeah, and you know, in the depths of winter, it can be quite a really swift process. You're talking, you know, down to the cove, 20 minutes later, I could be back home. But it's got to the stage now where even if I drive along the coast, I'd sometimes just do a loop around the town just to take a look at the sea and go, oh, hello sea, you know, or walk down on the beach, walk on the stones. And it's just become sort of a magical place that it clears my head just to be there.
That's when you do it on your own, but also when you do it with your friends, these women that you've mentioned. I mean, that solidarity, that companionship that you have, how important has that become to your life?
Well, Michelle and I particularly, because obviously they're not identical circumstances, but to have a friend who is going through something similar, or somebody who can wordlessly understand what you're going through, I mean, that's a gift, you know. And I mean, someday she's the only person that I want to talk to, because she just understands and I understand her situation. And then obviously that space where we're down by the sea, some days we'll just sit and talk for a while before, you know, we could be sitting there having a laugh, having a cry before we even get in the water. So yeah, it's a real bonding process, and we've probably all turned into total hippies.
What prompted you to write, first of all, a piece for the Irish Times, which then turned into a book offer, leading to the book now, I Found My Tribe?
Yeah, well, obviously, my husband was the guy who wrote for the paper, and he was the one doing the pieces and all of that, and doing the book. And I'd always written. When the kids were younger, I was working on a fiction book, which is sort of still sitting there with cobwebs on it a little bit. But through the whole process of Simon's diagnosis, just keeping a little journal in my bag was something that I did. And I spent years just between school runs, mostly sitting in parked cars, waiting for children to collect them or whatever. That was sort of my therapy, that I would just date the top of the page and just pour out what I thought were pretty miserable feelings. And it was just for myself. And I would be completely mortified at the idea that anyone might read it. that was just something that I'd done for years. And then I actually cobbled together a few of those together for the Irish Times piece. And I didn't write it for the Irish Times. I wrote it for a friend of mine who had a neurological diagnosis, and I was trying to persuade them to come out and swim, and showed it to my husband, which was the first move into something else, because he loved it. And obviously he had written for the Irish Times, and he said, please, can I show this to Roisin Ingle? And I was really nervous because I hadn't written it for anyone else to see. It was very personal. And he begged me, and then very dramatically sent Roisin an email saying, it is Ruth's time to speak, or something like that. My husband can be pretty dramatic. And yeah, she loved it too. And so I agreed to, I was excited then to publish it, but extremely nervous. And then when they printed it in January, it just went crazy. And so obviously that was hugely encouraging for me, because people didn't think it was miserable at all. They really, really related to it, and that was wonderful, you know.
But then that meant a commitment over the following 9 months to put all of your thoughts down and to structure a book. So how cathartic was that whole experience for you?
Yeah, it was an interesting year. It's quite an introspective process, and it all happened in a whirlwind, really, in the absolute sense of the word, because the article came out in January, and suddenly agents were getting in contact, and they wanted wanted me to write a book, and I wrote the first six chapters, had that done by the end of February, and the start of March then it was sent out, and I got a book deal. And so then it was from then until Christmas writing it. So my only window of writing was when all five kids are in school. So I would dump them to school, have a quick swim, dump them to school. See the way I said that? Only someone with five children
okay.
can
That's
say that.
Totally
you understand. And then I just go and write for the morning, sitting at my friend Afric and her husband Phil, their kitchen table for most of the time, and then pick up the kids. So yeah, it was, obviously it's really therapeutic writing about yourself, but you do become a bit odd, I think.
And how did Simon find it? How has Simon found the book for you? Because obviously he is central to the book as well. And your feelings towards him, and also, you know, dealing with the future that you've had.
I didn't let Simon read it until it was finished. And that was really, it was the same for him when he wrote his book. And that was really deliberate, because I knew that by osmosis, it's a wifely thing or a partner thing in general, that his feelings about it would affect how I was writing, even if I didn't realise it myself. And I couldn't do that, because it wouldn't be fair to anybody else who has a loved one that they look after or is in a similar situation to me. I know they totally out me and know, and I wouldn't be happy myself either. So it had to be that raw thing. And because I had all these journal entries, looking back in retrospect, I was able to access exactly how I felt at particular moments during particularly difficult times. And that was really important to me too, because I didn't want to look back and be maudlin or have it changed with the haze of memory and that kind of thing. So Simon didn't read it till it was finished, and I was obviously petrified then what he would think about it, or God, what if he wants me to change something? Will I want to change it? And just that it, obviously, he's the most important person to like it,
and because it was really, you love him, and that's what's
well. And I'm writing about him and our family, and but you know, motor neuron disease puts two people at polar opposites of the same thing, and so it's very hard for him to read some of the things that I've said, and I knew that, and I didn't want to hurt him, but I knew I just kept saying to him, look, Simon, there's nothing but love for you in that book, love in all its forms, and also there's that kind of female thing as well of I think women, and maybe I'm being totally sexist, but we sort of navigate emotions like waves, to use a sea pun, and I'm sort of saying to him, you know, when I say things like sometimes I'm looking at my husband and he looks like a stranger, you know, with intense eyes, it doesn't mean that I feel like that all the time. It's just a feeling that I'm having at that moment, and that changes to another feeling. So he kind of got it by the end, and he stopped halfway through and took a break from reading it, and said his beautiful quote about it's fucking mental being stuck inside your head, Ruth, I had to take a break. And I said, that's the most romantic thing you've ever said to me. Wow. And then he did, a few months ago, he picked it up again and read the end, and he finally said, yeah, I get it. And well done. It's beautiful.
It is beautiful.
It was like
few written.
And I collapsed on the floor.
It is beautifully written. I mean, it's an extraordinary story. It's an extraordinary life that you're leading and that your children are going through as well. I mean, they're in an extraordinary situation, these children as well.
Yeah.
And they have his story and they have your story that I suppose in, as adults they'll be able to appreciate as well, all that you've gone through during your time together.
Yeah, I really hope so, because, you know, kids at a certain age are fine, and then they get to that stage where they're mortified by everything that you do, and it's like, don't embarrass me. And so I'm kind of worried that in the teenage years they might possibly hate me for talking about them, because obviously I do document a lot of what they say, which I think is, it was a lovely habit to get into, to, you know, to write down the silly things that they say and document them. And then my son Rafe copped onto it and sort of would say, are you writing down what I'm saying? And is that going in the book? And I'm like, no, look, what's that over there? A squirrel, look, you know. So there was a bit of that, but I do hope that someday, when once they go through the hateful teenage years, that they will sort of see it eventually for what it is, which is a beautiful, you know, Simon's book too. It's a document of what their lives were like, and it might make them understand things a bit better. I hope so, but who knows? I mean, you know, things don't always work out. Motherly hopes sometimes don't come true, so we'll have to wait and see.
It's a beautiful book. I Found My Tribe, Ruth Fitzmaurice, as ever. Thank you very much, and best wishes to you and to Simon.
Thanks, Matt. Thank you.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.